From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was a basketball icon superstar for more than 20 years. All-time leading NBA scorer as towering center for the Milwaukee Bucks and the LA Lakers. Six NBA titles, same as Michael Jordan. Six-time MVP, won more than Jordan. A 7-foot-plus college convert to Islam who looms large over the game to this day. An all-star 19 times in an epic 20-season career, maybe the best ever. Now he's speaking to America's young. This hour on Point, the great Kareem Abdul-Jabbar on life, faith, the game, and his own journey. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What have you seen over the years in Kareem Abdul-Jabbar? What's your question for the athlete, the man? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us now from Santa Monica, California, is Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, basketball legend, multi-talented cultural icon, film actor, activist, author. He's out with a new book to inspire the young. It is Sasquatch in the Paint. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you with us. Thanks so much for coming in.
Well, nice talking with you, Tom.
You've done a lot with youth over the years. Since you got out of playing the game, we know you're still doing some coaching and advising out there. What's got you so focused in Sasquatch in the Paint and beyond on talking to America's young people these days?
I thought that my story, the experience I had when I was entering adolescence and getting ready to go to high school and trying to figure out what my life was going to be about, I kind of figured that that would be able to help a number of people, young people, because they all think that they're the only ones that are going through all of this. And it happens to every person. We all have to go through our adolescence and be awkward and unsure about what's going to happen to us. And just wanted to talk about it and give them an idea about what's going to happen and hopefully get them to understand that there's nothing to fear. It's just the natural process.
We know that Theo Rollins, the main character in your book, Sasquatch in the Paint, isn't exactly you, but as you say, he's got a lot in common. Introduce us to your character here, if you'd be good enough, author Kareem.
Well, Theo Rollins is someone who's just had a growth spurt, which is something that I had that really changed my life dramatically. His dad is a police officer. My dad was a police officer. He's kind of, I guess he would be considered nerdy because he's a good student. I was a good student and had to deal with that kind of issue. So in those ways, it's very similar to what I experienced. And my memories of going through that really helped me to nail that character down.
At age 9, you were 5'8". By the 8th grade, back in the days when you were Lou Alcindor, you were 6 feet, 8 inches tall and dunking. Now, your character in the book has got all kinds of kind of queasiness about this. The expectations of him are so high because he's so big. Of course, the basketball team thinks he's going to send them right to heaven. I've got a little tape of you. This is Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in 1967, then on the UCLA team, Lou Alcindor still in those days, talking with NBC News about his team, getting better, his mental preparation before the game, and some of his memories all the way back in 1967 of an incredible high school basketball career.
Well, I never did get butterflies. I remember my first game in high school, I had butterflies. I haven't had any butterflies since then. As far as getting up for the game is concerned, it's no problem. I want to win. I still have the desire to win. And I think as long as you have that, you won't have any problem getting ready for the game mentally.
1967, then Lou Alcindor, now Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and saying, no butterflies. I mean, the record that's kept and that we read back on now is just stellar season after stellar season, high school on. You know, what age were you when you were, you know, putting on that whatever it was, 8 inches and 6 inches in a summer, and gawky. Did you have that time, expectations you couldn't meet because of your size?
Well, I was just trying to keep up with everything, all the things that were happening to me. You know, just the growth. When I was in the sixth grade, I grew past my dad's height. So all of a sudden, now I'm 12 years old. I'm taller than most adults.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a kid. But mm-hmm. when people see someone that's as tall as an adult, they expect that person to be mature and act like an adult. And you can't do it. You have to figure out ways to fake it or somehow get by without creating too much criticism.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the point at which you began that shift from gawky, uncertain, very tall young prospect to, you know, oh my gosh, I'm leading teams to victory after victory. I'm on to something golden here. Do you remember when that happened?
I think that process happened between the 9th and 10th grade for me. So I played my 9th grade, I played varsity basketball in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And for those of you who don't know, varsity basketball in New York City, high school basketball, is a blood sport.
Yes.
And, you know, that one season got me ready for the rest of my life because in going through that, I had to, like, grow up a lot and figure out how to play the game and get control of my body. A whole lot of things that had to happen quickly if I was going to have a decent career. And I just, at that point, became very determined to succeed.
Power Memorial Academy, all-boys Catholic high school in Manhattan. They won 71 straight games with you on the team. 1963-64. The team was named the number one high school team of the century by national sports writers looking back from the year 2000. I mean, that was a pretty epic team, and you were the guy, that sort of towering guy in the middle making it happen. Did you have your sky hook back in high school?
Yeah, I started working on a hook shot when I was in the fifth grade. So it was something that – it was a tool that I had mastered before I got into high school. I didn't exactly – understand how to use it until I got into high school and played against people my own size and realized that it was a great tool and couldn't be blocked. But it took me a while. But I had the fundamentals up and down before I got into high school.
And, of course, you brought all kinds of change in your wake. College basketball had outlawed the dunk because you were so massively capable of it. But in all this time, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, you were – there was always some kind of conversation going on within you that didn't seem exactly ordinary. You weren't just going with the flow here. You could kind of, as we begin to look back on those tapes when you show up in college so famously at UCLA, you could almost see it on your face, a sort of interior dialogue about life and the world and your place in it. What was going on in your mind that looking at you, seems to set you apart all along?
Well, throughout my grade school years and through high school, I paid very close attention to what was happening in the civil rights movement. It was something that you couldn't ignore if you were a black American. And I think that really was probably the predominant thing in my mind that, you know, was affecting my life that I wanted to see change.
How did you think about it? We'll look at the social big level, but what about just personally? Your character in Sasquatch in the Paint is sensitive to race issues. I mean, you talk about his skin just burning when he hears a call from the crowd that calls out his color. What about your own personal thoughts in those high school years about race, your race?
Well, you know, there were a lot of traumatic things that happened during that time. The bombing in Birmingham, mm-hmm. of course, Dr. King's March on Washington, and, you know, the run-up to and the signing of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, all those things really meant a lot to black Americans. And I think those things really, if you were black at that time, you could not ignore what was going on with regard to those issues.
But there's a point in the book where young Theo's mom goes after him because he makes an excuse for a bad grade, says it's because he's black. And she says, you know, every time you make the excuse, because I'm black, you're putting a dollar in this jar. Was that your family experience? Was that the attitude in your household?
No, it wasn't. But I did that because a lot of young people now seem to look for easy excuses as to why they can't perform to a certain level or accomplish certain things. And that, for many young people today, that's something that they try to fall back on. So I inserted that in there.
Why do you think that's become, if you're correct, that it's become more common to use it as an excuse? Why do you think that would be when, you know, objectively outside, things have gotten better in many ways?
Yeah, it has, but it's convenient, you know, and they don't really understand how bad things were, you know, during the time when Jim Crow laws were in effect and black Americans were kept from doing anything having to do with success.
Supreme Court has an affirmative action case before it right now that would make it harder for affirmative action to stay in place. Would you favor ratcheting back affirmative action given that attitude?
Well, I understand what people are trying to achieve through affirmative action. You know, I agree with those goals. Maybe some of the remedies that they use did not have the effect that they wanted to, but I think the intention behind it was laudable, and it's something that we actually need to continue to resolve.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is All On Point. We're talking this hour with all-time basketball great NBA superstar Kareem Abdul-Jabbar about that life, the whole of his life, and young people coming of age. He's on that theme in his new book, It Is Sasquatch in the Paint, a book for young readers about sticking to it, about finding yourself, about knowing what you believe in, and applying yourself to it, kind of inspirational book with no small modeling on his own young life. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar joins us from Santa Monica, California. Kareem, lots of commentary for you online here. Douglas says, goes without saying, the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar skyhook was one of the most beautiful, awe-inspiring things to see in all of sport. Thank you, Kareem. Margie says, my hero when I was a fourth-rate forward in an extramural college team. Thanks, Kareem, for the beautiful style. And lots of questions and people calling in for you as well. Let's go to Milwaukee, your old stomping grounds. First NBA team, the Bucks. That was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Michael, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom, and thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'd like to express my appreciation to Kareem for helping to bring the Milwaukee Bucks its sole NBA championship in 1971.
Yeah.
Sadly, it's all but forgotten today. But I think he's the greatest NBA player ever, because if I was constructing an NBA franchise, I would take Kareem in his prime over any player ever in his prime. But I wanted to ask Kareem, do you have any regrets for not participating in the U.S. Olympic team of 1968, even though the black boycott of the 68 Olympics had a higher and nobler purpose? Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Michael. Kareem?
You know, I'm very comfortable with what happened. For a number of us, you know, it was impossible for me to participate in the Olympics because I wanted to get out of college. I had a great job and, you know, a great summer job, and I wanted to deal with that so I'd have the money that I needed to finish my senior year in college and get my degree. So that was really what was motivating me. I didn't really participate in the boycott as such.
So it wasn't a race statement on your part, but rather sort of getting it done, getting what you needed done.
Right, and it had to do with just practical issues in my life that, you know, made me feel that it was best for me to, like, just not go to the Olympics, do my job and save my money so that I could get through my final school year without any financial hassles.
The main character in your book has real struggles balancing academics, which he's very interested in, and sport. What about for you? How high was your passion for the academic side? And what about that balance today with college athletes? What do you see in the balance or lack of balance?
Well, for me, I always wanted to graduate from college. I'm the first person in my family with a degree. So that was an important thing for me and something that I was not going to leave without. But I think that today it's unfortunate for so many athletes that they don't get to go to college and have that foundation in their lives. A lot of them need it. And by not participating in the college experience, I think they're losing something. I think our nation has lost something. We're not going to see too many more athletes become Rhodes Scholars. And why not? You know, this is something that is a great achievement, and it sets a great example for our young people that they can be athletes and they can be scholars.
You managed to be a great athlete and academically committed. Why do you think that's not happening as much today?
I think that people see having a sports career as an end in itself, and it really isn't. So many young people that get the opportunity to go straight from high school into professional athletics, they have a hard time when their athletic career is over because they don't have the educational foundation to enable them to do other things. So I think that, the athletes themselves are not getting the full benefit of what they should.
Given the emphasis then on professionalism, here's Alicia asks on Facebook of you, and this is right out of the headlines, but she says, should NCAA athletes be paid to play? There's a lot of talk about that these days. What do you think?
I think that NCAA athletes are exploited, and they should get paid. So many of them, you have a situation where, let's say, a young man goes to a college to play football, and he gets hurt while he's playing football, he can't continue to have a scholarship. His scholarship can be rescinded, and there is no insurance program that will protect them, enable them to finish their college career. They went and held up their end of the bargain and went to the school to do what they were asked to do. And as soon as they get hurt, the school, reneges on its commitment. So there are a number of abuses like that really are – they don't sit well with me. And I think that, so many of the college athletes that make all this money, it's a $6 billion a year industry. So many people see college athletics as more or less a very benevolent extension of high school athletics, where the quarterback and one of the cheerleaders has a romance and they celebrate the victory over their arch rivals at the malt shop.
Right.
That's not happening anymore. Those days are over. This is a business here. And making all that money, producing all that money, I think, and not getting a chance to participate in the financial rewards, I think, is really exploitation.
So if you would like to see college athletes paid, have you thought about how you would do it? Would you pay them at a kind of stipend level, pocket money, or would you give them a real market value kind of paycheck, maybe a big one?
It's a difficult thing to sort out because there are certain sports, college basketball and college football, are really the giants in this picture. They make the majority of the money. The guys on the swimming on the water polo team on the gymnastics team, they're not generating a whole lot of revenue for the school, but the basketball team and the football team are generating huge amounts of money. So, there has to be a way to figure out how to do it in a sensible, equitable way. But the whole ideal of a college representing a place where athletically and intellectually human beings can reach their highest peak, I think that should be the ideal. And it's gotten a long way from there.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is with us. Mohammed is calling from Milwaukee again. Mohammed, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Assalamu alaikum, brother Kareem.
Wa alaikum salam.
Eid Mubarak.
Shukran.
Okay. Now, I always like to watch you playing, and something I really liked about the way you played, you played like unselfishly. You always give passes to your co-players, where everyone has had a chance to make a point. And I think that's very admirable of you.
Well, thank you very much.
And I want And I want to ask you another question. Did you make it to Mecca yet?
Yes, I have. I made it for Umrah.
To Mecca for Hajj? Is that the?
Not Hajj. Umrah. Umrah is the lesser pilgrimage when you can't go during the month of Hajj. So you still go, but you perform the rites, but it's not during the month of Hajj. That's called Umrah. So I've done that. I haven't had the opportunity to go during Hajj.
Muhammad, thank you for your call. We hear the Arabic greeting there, kind of Islamic greeting. Well, I guess it was in college that you made the decision to turn from, had you been raised a Catholic, to
yes.
Islam. Yes, and we've got people asking what motivated you to make that decision then.
Well, you know, during my freshman year at UCLA, I read the autobiography of Malcolm X, mm-hmm. and it made me very curious about Islam. So I started to read about it, and it made a lot of sense to me. And, you know, I had a genuine religious conversion.
What was the specific appeal of Islam to you in those days? Was it the black Muslim profile of Islam? Was it the more mainstream Muslim message?
I've never been involved with the black Muslims. It was the fact that I could see where the New Testament was a kind of, there's a little bit of fiction in there. So that's one of the things that Muslims are so keen about, because Christians worship Jesus. Muslims, we don't worship Jesus. We understand that he is a prophet and someone to be admired and emulated, but we don't worship him. And that's really the main issues between Muslims and Christians. But in terms of who, you know, we worship the God of Abraham, and we feel that any monotheistic religion is correct and incompatible with our beliefs.
So how would you describe the difference in between the veneration of Muhammad, the Islamic prophet, and Jesus?
Jesus is worshipped as part of a trinity of divine entities. Mm-hmm. Muhammad is revered as a prophet, someone who conveyed a message from the supreme being to mankind. That was his function, but we see him as a human being and not someone that's divine or someone that we worship.
What's happened with your Islamic faith and practice over the years as Islam moved from sort of a distant, kind of remote and exotic religion to one that's right been in the last dozen years in the middle of American politics, security concerns, social tensions? What influence has all that had on your practice or outlook?
Well, I was very disappointed to have so many Muslims, especially in the Middle East, turn to fascism. You know, this whole idea of authoritarian Islamic State that, you know, like the Taliban or Mr. bin Laden's group. This is not what Islam is all about, and it's very unfortunate that it has gotten this stigma about it because of the radicalization of people in the Middle East. It's very unfortunate, but it's something that we have to deal with. But, you know, I feel that as a Muslim, I can be a loyal and patriotic American, and there should not be any conflict.
What's your analysis of why some Muslims have gravitated toward that expression? You call it fascism. Why do you think that's happened?
I think it has to do with the experience, the colonial experience that happened throughout the Muslim world, where, you know, those countries were colonized by European powers that exploited them for their natural resources and looked down upon them because of their Islamic faith, and they're still trying to recover from that experience, and it has not been a good experience.
Does that make it a justified anger?
Well, anger may be justified, but violence, no. And especially attacking innocent people, terrorism is not a way to solve problems. And, you know, that's that's something that has to be realized by everybody.
Do you watch Homeland ever, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar? I don't know if you've watched.
I've watched one or two episodes of it.
Well, I mean, what do you? You know, you've got the character there who was taken captive, American military for many years, converted to Islam, and then is back in the U.S. and sort of torn. Can you relate at all to that? That fictional depiction of what a man might go through between these two cultures, or trying to carry both in his heart and mind?
Yeah, I can see. You know what they're trying to convey there, but you know, murder is murder. You know, you can't justify it, and no matter what side of the issue, the political issues you're on, murder is murder. So you know, attacking innocent people and you know just using violence to settle issues is counterproductive, and it's never going to work.
Let's go to Terry in Florence, South Carolina. Hi, Terry. You're on with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I want to give a shout-out to Kareem. I've watched you as a young man play basketball and always admire the way you carry yourself. And also, even more importantly, what you do now off the court, I think is very important that young African-American males see a positive image of an African American, and I want to also ask you, why isn't there? And you probably don't know the answer. That more African American athletes are involved with the African American community which they grew up in. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Well, to answer your question, I think that so many young African American athletes, especially, think that it's all over. That the struggle is over. That we got everything we needed to get back in 1968, the affirmative action and you know, the access to being able to vote has made everything right, and it's not still right. Racism still is an issue. Look at what we're going through now with the voter suppression attempts and other things that restrict Black Americans from full participation in the American democracy. So we still have a long way to go, and you know, unfortunately, too many young Black Americans don't get it, and it's just on the older generation, my generation, to point these things out and give them an idea of where they can still get things done that really need to be done.
You still work with pro ball players, with the LA Lakers, and more over time. Do they resonate with that view that you've just expressed?
Most of them don't. You know, most of them don't see that. You know, they because there are no more Jim Crow offenses going on, and it's not blatant. A lot of young Black Americans don't see what the problem is, and you know, that's very unfortunate, but gotta just keep spreading the word.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with all-time basketball great NBA superstar Kareem Abdul-Jabbar about that life, the whole of his life, and young people coming of age. He's on that theme in his new book, Sasquatch in the Paint, just out, about a young man, much like he once was, wrestling with sport and academics and life, with race and faith, and all the complexities that young people face coming up. He joins us today from Santa Monica, California. Kareem, here's Renee writes to us on Facebook. She says, oh, speaking to you here directly, she says, oh, you made me cry so many times as a little girl in Boston, playing the Celtics, I guess. Now you only make me smile, a thoughtful, reflective, erudite man with unblockable hook shot. It was an honor to watch you play. Do a little basketball reminiscence with us for a moment here. Back to that famous 1985 NBA Finals game against the Celtics. I don't know how you are at calling up, summoning up memories of individual games, but that was a famous one. Lakers defeated in that first game. You went on to win the series and the championship, but defeated 148-114. They called it the Memorial Day Massacre. You had only 12 points. That was unheard of. Only 3 rebounds. You were 38 years old, and, you know, for a few minutes there, people said you were washed up. You came back like gangbusters and took the whole thing. But can you take us back to that game and what was going on there?
Basically, we had had a tough road through the playoffs and finally got into the finals against the Celtics, something we wanted to do because we felt that we had given away a championship the year before to the Celtics.
Yeah.
So we're very happy to have the opportunity to play them. And just for me, I just had a letdown. You know, having made it that far, I was like, wow, we're almost there.
Yeah.
And I didn't prepare like I needed to prepare for the finals. They came out, they had an incredible shooting game from long range. I think they made 7 of 10 3-point shots. That was really the key to their victory.
You managed to bounce back in a hurry and take that championship. What did you turn to bounce back? Did you just go and have a conversation with yourself in the locker room? What was your strategy?
Well, for me, I just felt that, I'd worked too hard and come too far to just go flat at that point. So I just had to raise my effort. We were very fortunate in that the next game that we played the Celtics was on Thursday. That was a Sunday afternoon game. The next game we played was on Thursday. So Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, we had more or less a mini camp, a mini training camp, and just got mentally and physically ready to play at our highest level. And everything fell in place, and we won 4 out of the next 5 games to take the world championship.
You're giving advice, in effect, through this book to young people on how to sort of keep their heads and make their way in the world. There were a couple of famous times in your career when you lost your temper, and it cost you a broken hand back in 74. You punched the support stanchion under the basket after a hard foul. There was another punch. I think you broke your hand again. What was it that drove you sort of to those moments?
Well, the first incident you talk about, somebody stuck their finger in my eye, and I was in a lot of pain.
And it put you in goggles after that for a long time.
Yeah, and I wore goggles for the rest of my career because, my face was right around the area where people were swinging at the ball, and inevitably, there's going to be some contact, and I got a finger in my eye. And the second time, somebody took a slug at me, and I lost it again. But, the things that you go through that infuriate you are a lot. There are a number of things that can really get you, off your game. And that is something you always have to be on guard on guard against, because you can't let yourself, you can't give in to your emotional outbursts. It doesn't work. You end up doing crazy stuff.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Jane is calling for you from Herman, New York. Hi, Jane. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm about Kareem's age, and I spent my whole youth watching him, and I just felt that he wasn't happy. And I think he seems much happier now. And I was wondering if he ever felt limited by the fact that he was so tall and basketball was so obviously going to be in his life, that he ever, wished that he could do something else. And thank you. I'll take the answer offline.
Jane, thank you. Kareem, how about it? I mean, people used to say, oh, that Kareem, he's got a sourness, a sullenness. Jane just sees less happiness then and more now. What about it?
You can tell, Jane, it wasn't that I wasn't happy, but I was just always on guard. I just had a very guarded personality. All I wanted to do was play the game and go home. I didn't want to answer questions. I didn't want to be a focus of so much scrutiny. And I think that's what came across. And, you know, it's really unfortunate because I do like people. I do like to interact with people. Mm-hmm. But there was just everybody wanted to relate to me with regard to basketball. And there was so much more to me than that. And I just hadn't found the ways to change the subject in a way that made everybody comfortable. You know, I've been able to do that since I've retired, and things have gone a lot better with regard to those issues.
Do you think that's because the sort of fame and spotlight hit you so hard so early that you didn't have time to figure out a kind of strategy? It was a lot of years to carry that. I mean, 20 years just in the NBA is a long time. You've said since I was way too suspicious and I paid a price for it.
Yeah, I was very suspicious. And when I was, especially like in grade school and high school, all black Americans were judged by the actions of a few. So you couldn't really be yourself. You had to take on the burden of being someone that if you did something crazy, all black people would be judged by what you did.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, today that's not the case, you know.
Yeah,
guys can be crazy and goofy, and it's okay. Not everybody is judged by that. But you know, I think there was an extra burden of just so much fear that the scrutiny would be transferred and related to other black Americans in an unfavorable way. So I was like very uptight in that sense, and never really let my real personality out because I was afraid of the criticism.
We're glad you found more freedom now. It's really great. One more basketball question. We'll go wider again. Douglas writes for you on Facebook. He says, does today's NBA, based on pace and floor spacing, make the role of the traditional center obsolete? Is that good or bad? Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
No, the traditional center's job hasn't changed that much. It's just that there are not as many of them that are learning how to play the game there. But if you have a center that can do the things around the basket that win games, you're going to want that person on the court near the basket all the time. You're not going to have that person out playing at the three-point line.
There's plenty of tall guys out there. Why aren't they learning the game, as you put it?
Because and it's an element of style. They like to shoot the 3-point shot. You know, it's like lotto fever.
Yeah, right,
you know,
right.
It's kind of like lotto fever. Yeah. So you know, just shooting the 3-point shot is something that they can make gestures to the crowd. But what five guys do closer to the basket really wins games. Getting high percentage shots. Close to the basket, playing tough defense, rebounding, those types of things. That's what wins the game. And, you know, not every basketball player nowadays understands that, but that's how games are won.
Claudio in Groton, Connecticut. Claudio, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm in the Navy. I've been able to have the chance to travel the world. In fact, in 2011, I just got back from a WestPac visiting the Pacific, and I loved it. The
Great.
Interesting thing that I did see, however, was the type of racism seen there and in the rest of the world compared to the U.S. is different. And on top of that, the racism in the States is changing. I'll explain. In Malaysia and in Indonesia, it was mainly religious. And yes, they had hatred towards blacks and towards whites, yet at the same time, it was more of a resentment for them impeding in their land rather than them specifically being the color.
Okay.
And in the States, it's also changing towards that with the Hispanics mainly. And there's a bit of, I would say, ignorance. For a lot of my colleagues, when we go overseas, they would come with a perspective of how something is And when they reach the land, they realize it's completely different.
Claudio, our time is short. Let us pick it up right there. I mean, like you, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar has traveled plenty. What have you seen in terms of race relations abroad versus the United States, Kareem?
Well, I found that I think what the gentleman was referring to is the fact that economic status really engenders a lot more discrimination than racial status. So, you know, people who have money and wealth usually have the power to have very comfortable lives, and people who don't have wealth and economic power have a much tougher time. I think that's the trend. I think that's the way that things are going.
You watch the news. In the last few days, we've had the default crisis in Washington, D.C. We've had demonstrations with Confederate flags displayed outside the White House. That is President Barack Obama's home currently. What did you think when you saw that?
It was disgusting. The Confederate flag is the flag of people who violently opposed union with the United States and wanted to maintain slavery. This is pretty much an accepted fact. So when you're doing that, the implication of violence and by waving it, you are asserting your own superiority over black Americans who were the subject of what the Civil War was about. So, you know, it's a statement, and it's all signals. It's not blatant, but the assumptions behind the waving of that flag are very obvious. So, you know, it was pretty disgusting, and it just goes to show that things haven't changed that much.
What do you think about how Barack Obama has handled the presidency and the role that the first black American president and the role that race has or has not played in his presidency?
I think President Obama has done a great job, especially given the hostility and opposition that he has faced every step of the way in trying to get things done for our nation. You know, most people who are objective can see that he's worked very hard to do his job, and that he's been opposed by people who don't like the fact that a black American has become president of the United States. They can't accept that, and they want to do everything they can to discredit his efforts to lead our country. I think it's really unfortunate. It's unpatriotic, and America deserves better than that. President Obama has done his best job, and he is a loyal and faithful and very competent administrator, and he didn't deserve the treatment that he got from so many people in the Congress.
Bill in Gloucester, Massachusetts, you're on. Thanks for calling, Bill.
Hi, Tom. I had a question for Kareem about his martial arts training when he was younger, and I just wanted to know what it was like to work with Bruce Lee and what kind of lessons he took away from working with him.
Thank you, Bill. A lot of people asking about that. You were with Bruce Lee in the film The Game of Death. You actually fought him on film there. Who set that up? How did that happen, Kareem? What was that relationship?
Well, I worked out with Bruce starting my junior year at UCLA. I worked out with him for about 4 years. He was a great guy, man. He was down to earth, very approachable. He was way ahead of the curve in terms of knowing how martial arts should be applied. There was a movie that just came out in the last 2 months called Grandmaster. It talks about Bruce's his teacher, Mr. Ip Man. I think anybody who's into Bruce's life should see that movie. You'll learn a lot about the man that taught him and what his whole philosophy was about. But Bruce was really ahead of his time in that he understood that martial arts training should be eclectic, and that no one style is dominant. You have to learn from the whole experience of martial arts. Excuse me. And if you can do that, you will be trained well and understand how to defend yourself.
Your interests have spread so widely in the years since your NBA career. How often do you pick up a ball these days? I mean, and do you do it for yourself? I know you still do some work assistant coaching with the Lakers. Is it when you're there? I mean, do you touch a basketball much?
I'm not with the Lakers anymore, but, you know, I teach people, like my friend, my co-author, Raymond Obstfeld, his son wants to learn how to play, so I've worked with him a little bit, and a couple of NBA guys have come to me from time to time and want to bone up on a few things. So I kind of use those opportunities to keep my hand in it.
You shoot hoops for fun, or that's history?
Oh, that's history. I don't do that much, but I do try to stay in shape.
Well, you keep your mind in shape as well, and we really appreciate it. It's been great to have you with us this hour. The new book is Sasquatch in the Paint. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar joined us from Santa Monica, California. Thank you so much for all of your incredible athleticism and all the thinking and sharing that you've done in the years since. Really terrific. Thanks so much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure, Tom. Thank you so much. You know, I'm still here because I take my medicine every day. You know, I have leukemia. I take my medicine Tasigna every day, and it keeps me alive and well and able to do this. So I'm very happy to be with you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Live right, live long. This is On Point.